True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
When Joanne Witt was brutally murdered in her own home, she had been working as a civil engineer, supporting her daughter on her own. Being a single mother to a rebellious young teen is not easy, but Joanne was devoted, she was hardworking, and she was loving toward her daughter. After all, her daughter Tyler was the center of her world. Join us at the quiet end for Tyler Witt's Diary. Tyler, at age 14, was angry and out of control. When she entered into a sexual relationship with an older man, Joanne tried everything she could think of to stop it and help her daughter make better decisions. But Tyler's relationship with 19-year-old Stephen Culver was like a runaway train. No amount of parental love or discipline could derail it. Focused on saving her daughter, it was Joanne who paid the ultimate price for love.
And this took place in the state of California, so of course I have a California beer. And this is another one from Russian River Brewing Company, one of my favorite places. This is Sanctification. It's a Brett beer, which means it's a wild ale fermented spontaneously. So it's a clear straw color, big huge white head, a little bit of lace, has a dry woody aroma, a little bit of spice. And taste is kind of woody, which tastes better than it sounds, maybe. A lemon and some grape. And it's a nice, tart little beer. Very good.
Yeah, low alcohol, right?
4.8%.
So that's good.
We can drink a whole bottle of this.
Oh, maybe several.
Well,
4.8%?
Don't get ahead of yourself there.
I won't. All right, we'll start slow. Let's open one bottle and see what we think.
Okay, here we go.
I already know what you think. All right, come join me down here at the quiet end, if you will. And I'm going to have you start out this story. Fascinating story. I was really surprised we hadn't heard of it sooner.
Yeah, it's a sad story. Well,
they're all sad.
All of them that we do are sad. This one is tough. So by all accounts, Joanne Witt loved and wanted the best for her daughter. Their relationship, however, was at times very strained. The trouble between Tyler Witt and her mother, Joanne, began in early childhood. When she was just a five-year-old, Joanne hit her in a moment when she lost control of her anger. She was driving in the car. Tyler is screaming and kicking. When they got to daycare, one of the providers noticed a red mark on Tyler's face. So Joanne confessed to striking her daughter, and CPS was contacted. After the report of abuse, Tyler was put in foster care, and then moved into the custody of Joanne's parents while Joanne took parenting classes. So I'm wondering, as an aside here, this is one time she slapped the child.
Yeah, I think so.
And she's taken out of the home, placed in foster care.
I know. It does seem a little...
So I'm thinking that it must have been something else.
Well, I don't know if there was more abuse or if Tyler was just very difficult for her to deal with. So they wanted her to take parenting classes.
Yeah, you can take parenting classes and still have custody of your child.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. I've looked into it as far as I could, and that's all I could find out. Another question I wasn't able to answer is, where was the dad? It doesn't seem like he was ever in the picture at all, and I'm not sure why.
Single mother,
yep.
Right?
Yes. I've read things from the parents, the brothers, about her being a single mom, but no one ever mentioned the father. So I almost think she planned to have a child on her own.
Yeah. Yeah. She just found a sperm donor.
I think she might have, yeah. But regardless, this is the way things happened.
Right. So Tyler was eventually returned to her mother's custody. But according to Joanne's parents, Joanne was afraid to discipline Tyler after that. And as Tyler got older, she recognized the power that this gave her. So whenever her mother said no to something that Tyler wanted to do, Tyler would threaten to call the police or CPS. She just had absolutely no respect for her mother's rules or her mother's feelings.
Well, for most of her childhood, Joanne and her daughter were very close. According to family and friends, Joanne worked hard to provide Tyler with a really beautiful home and all the things she wanted. But Tyler had more power in the relationship than what was healthy, it seems. As Tyler reached her early teens, she became rebellious to the point where physical fights would happen between her and her mother. Joanne felt out of control a lot of the time. There was no doubt that Joanne tried to take excellent care of her daughter, though. After that episode when Tyler was 5, there's no indication that Joanne was an abusive parent at all. But Tyler was prone to throwing out the words abusive alcoholic about her mother when she was upset with her. Joanne had lupus and was on medication. But when she got tired as a reaction to the medication, and if she had a drink or two, Tyler would be extremely critical of her. And just, you know, tell her friends that her mom was a useless drunk and things like that. So it wasn't very nice.
It sure wasn't. Then when she was 12 or 13, Tyler began getting into trouble at school. She ran away from home more than once. And in the months before Joanne was killed, she had been trying to crack down on Tyler's misbehavior and offer more discipline. But then this would lead to violent fights, where Joanne would try and get Tyler to stay in her room and Tyler would hit her mother. The CPS was brought in several times. Tyler told them that her mother was a drunk who beat her. Now, there was no sign of alcoholism or abuse, and Tyler was not removed from the home at this time. Her accusations of being abused were just not proven, and she never had any injuries.
So in 2009, 19-year-old Stephen Culver was living in El Dorado Hills, California. He had the nickname Boston, not because he'd ever lived there, but because he had a speech impediment where he would leave the R's off of words like a Boston native would. But he had gotten some speech therapy and mostly had overcome that. He liked to spend his spare time at a local coffee shop where he had friends who shared his interests. So he was into a gothish kind of look, and he would wear black clothing a lot. And he also loved to watch and read Japanese anime and manga. So overall, people liked Stephen, and this included many adults and even his friends' parents. Jacqueline Epperson, for example, the mother of Stephen's friend Courtney, said that he was reliable. She trusted in Stephen and would allow her daughter to go places with him, knowing he respected her rules and would not mistreat her daughter. Jacqueline saw him as a young man with a strong work ethic. He was self-motivated and very helpful to others. And his long-term goal, he told her, was to become a math teacher. So that sounded like a very honorable, realistic goal.
Yeah, this sounds okay to me so far.
Yeah, so he did seem okay to a lot of people. He enjoyed cooking. And he even liked to make his own original ice cream flavors. After Stephen took a job at an ice cream parlor, he got permission to experiment with different ice cream flavors and invent his own combinations. So for some time, there were samples of his recipes for customers to try, and some were even added to the menu. Despite Stephen's love of anime, which includes bloody confrontations and fighting, no one thought of him as a violent guy. In fact, he seemed peace-loving, and he had no history of violence at all.
Now, his relationship with 14-year-old Tyler Witt began when the two met at his favorite coffee shop, and they quickly became friends. As Tyler shared more with him about her home life, he believed that she lived with an alcoholic mother who mentally and physically abused her. In reality, Joanne was not an alcoholic, and she didn't abuse her daughter. In point of fact, she loved Tyler and did everything she could for her.
Yeah, that seems to be something that everybody believed. Nobody believed that she abused Tyler at all.
Yeah.
And in fact, when Stephen first met Tyler's mom, Joanne, those two got along pretty well. Stephen was living with his father, but Tyler was then able to convince her mother into letting him move in with them. Stephen seemed mature and he was respectful to Joanne. And he seemed to treat Tyler like a younger sister, offering to help her with her grades, and he also helped out around the house, which was really nice for Joanne, who was working full-time, had this difficult daughter, and she could use someone to rent a room from her, also to help with the mortgage.
Right. Got that. Plus her lupus probably made it difficult for her to do a lot of activities.
I know, right? After working full time?
Yeah.
And then Stephen was able to convince Joanne that he was gay, so she wouldn't have any worries that he would get romantically involved with Tyler.
Yeah, that covered the bases.
It seemed to.
Because otherwise, I'm not sure. If I'm a single mom, I don't think I'd want a 19-year-old male living in my house with my 14-year-old bratty daughter.
Yeah, sure.
It sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Well, and it was.
Which turns out.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I can see. It sounds like they had done some planning on this. And so, yeah, Stephen's gay.
Yeah, and I think that Joanne was kind of desperate. She was having a hard time. So he seemed like someone that was going to help, which he certainly wasn't.
Yeah, that's true. It was during spring break in 2009. Joanne was looking for a boarder. She's comfortable with Stephen. So Tyler asked her why not rent a room to him. Tyler and Stephen had already become lovers by this time, so Tyler certainly would like the idea of having him in her house. That meant they would be able to spend a lot more time together and have sex while Joanne was asleep or out of the house. And Joanne had no idea that they were boyfriend and girlfriend, and she believed them when they told her that they were like brother and sister.
Before Stephen had moved in, he, Joanne, and Tyler shared a dinner with Stephen's father and his father's girlfriend. His father was selling his house, and he had asked Stephen to move out by the end of the summer. And according to Stephen's father, Richard Culver, it was a strange dinner conversation. He said that Joanne and Tyler seemed to be in a competition over which of them was the smartest, and there was obviously a lot of friction between the mother and daughter. But despite some of the reservations he had about his son moving in with them, he decided it was okay for his son to move into the Witt house. Now, of course, he didn't know either that his son was having sex with the girl.
Sure.
After Stephen had moved into their home in El Dorado Hills, he and Tyler had more sex than ever before. They were able to keep their secret for quite a while, but in Tyler's diary, she wrote about her excitement for sex with Stephen and described the details of the sex that they did have. She wrote that they loved each other and nothing could ever tear them apart. Stephen paid Joanne $500 a month for a bedroom and the use of the bathroom and kitchen, and during the week he had a busy work and school schedule. In the afternoons, he would do many of the household chores. On Saturday mornings, Joanne would let Tyler go out and spend time with friends. On Sundays, Joanne and Tyler and Stephen would eat breakfast together. Stephen would volunteer to wash the dishes. He was there for most of Joanne and Tyler's arguments, which would sometimes escalate into screaming matches. And at this point, Tyler's school grades were not good. She was smoking cigarettes, and she was repeatedly breaking her curfew.
And during this time period, Tyler wrote TW and SC forever in one of her school notebooks. And she also wrote a poem about Stephen, pronouncing that she loved him because he is honest and kind. She wrote that he was a beautiful person who was loyal, dependable, and funny. He made her laugh, made her love her life, and gave her hope. She said he wanted the best for her, and he had respect for her. She added one more disturbing thought, that he loved her even though she was not worth loving.
So, of course, that's disturbing because we're thinking about her self-esteem and what was going on there.
Exactly.
And we know she had a lot of issues. She had done cutting before and other types of self-abuse. Now, in another page of her notebook, Tyler wrote that she loved Stephen so much that it scared her at times. It scared her to think of what might happen to her if she ever lost him. She didn't think he really understood how much she loved him, and she said it would probably scare him to know how deep her feelings were for him. So when she was skipping classes, Stephen told her that she shouldn't do that, that she needed to get a good education. He even contacted her math teacher and tried to help her with improving her grades. He presented himself to the teacher as if he was like a big brother figure to her. So the only people who knew about the sexual relationship were some of their friends and peers. And according to many of them, Stephen did show genuine concern over Tyler, particularly her habit of cutting herself when she got really upset. Still, he didn't show any concern about how sex with an adult might hurt her psychologically. When she's 19, would he really consider that? Obviously he should.
I don't know.
That didn't seem to occur to him.
Yeah.
But you have to think, she never had a father in her life, so she already has that issue. So if this older guy is showing her attention, I mean, you can almost assume that she's going to really be into that.
Uh-huh, you can.
So it was really his responsibility not to follow through with it, but he did anyway. So on May 13th, 2009, Joanne walked into her house's utility room, and she found a bottle of sexual lubricant, some sex toys, and some marijuana. Initially, she may have thought the sex stuff was something Stephen used in his supposed gay relationships, but she didn't want any marijuana or illegal drugs in her home where her daughter would have access to them. So Joanne confronted Stephen. He was calm. He told her that he was just holding the marijuana for a friend. Never heard that one before. And he never used it himself.
I don't use that stuff.
He didn't really explain the sexual items to her at all, but Joanne decided to let him stay in her home if he got rid of the drugs.
So that seemed to be the end of it, but Tyler and Stephen's deception got exposed the very next day, May 14th. Joanne came home early from work and went to Tyler's room, but Tyler wasn't there. She then went to Stephen's room and knocked on his door. He didn't answer, but Joanne heard voices inside. When he finally did open the door, he had on pants but no shirt. So Joanne's concerned that something's going on behind her back, and she checked inside of Stephen's closet and in an unfinished room next door. Tyler was naked in that room, holding a sports bra up to hide her breasts. Now Joanne was stunned, and she realized that Stephen and Tyler had been having sex together all along. So certainly she felt anger with both of them and complete betrayal by Stephen.
So at that point, Stephen thought that he would go to federal prison after being convicted for the statutory rape of Tyler. They had no idea at that point if Joanne was going to turn Stephen into the police, but she did stay remarkably calm as she dealt with this new reality. Joanne didn't make any accusations right away, but she asked Stephen to take a ride with her later that afternoon to talk, and she confronted him. And Stephen admitted that he and Tyler were sexually involved. He told her that he knew it was wrong, but that they really did love each other. Joanne thought over her next move. She could call the police, or she could try and handle this on her own. So she made the decision to try and handle it on her own. She told Stephen if he moved out of the house and never saw Tyler again, she wouldn't call the police. And this seemed like a generous offer, considering what had been going on under her own roof, so Stephen agreed. He asked her to give him 2 weeks to find a new place to live, and Joanne agreed, but things became very difficult with Tyler right away, and she and Joanne began to argue more than ever. So the very next day, May 15th, Stephen was told he had to move out. Joanne had two male friends from her workplace, Vinny and Thor, which are intimidating names.
Yeah, they sure are. Hope their physical build lives up to those names.
Maybe not Thor, but they did seem like kind of tough guys. So they came over to put Stephen's things out front, and when they showed up at her home, they lectured Stephen about everything he had done. They're trying to help out and make it so that he wouldn't consider coming back. So Stephen didn't argue with the men. He just said yes, sir, to everything they told him. But Joanne had wanted those men there so she wouldn't be alone with Stephen and Tyler trying to get him out of the house. So they tried to help Joanne intimidate Stephen, and they warned him to stay away. But according to these two guys, Stephen did not seem intimidated by them at all. So he moved into a male friend's house, but then he continued to see Tyler. They discussed their situation and considered running away together. And Joanne wasn't stupid. She suspected that they were still meeting behind her back, and she really didn't know what to do about this. It's a tough situation for her.
And so in early June, Joanne found and read Tyler's diary. Now, Tyler had written in the diary about the sexual positions and activities they had done together. She also wrote that they weren't using any birth control.
How alarming for a mother.
No kidding. So Tyler had written about how deeply in love she and Stephen were with each other. And additionally, she vented her anger at her mother and wrote out detailed fantasies where her mom died in a car accident and she was free to live her own life with Stephen. In one entry, Tyler wrote that she wished that her mother would die. She didn't care how, she wrote, but she wished she could just leave Tyler, quote, the fuck alone, unquote.
She just seems like a charming young lady.
Difficult.
Not.
Adolescence.
Absolutely. Well, Joanne was understandably upset. To try and find a way to fix things without making Tyler even angrier, she decided to call the police over to the house and have them talk with Tyler. Then, if Tyler refused to confess to what had been happening with Stephen, Joanne would give the diary to the El Dorado County Sheriff's Office as evidence. Detective Ken Barber came over to the Witt House on June 10th to talk to Tyler. And Tyler said later, "He asked me about my relationship with Boston. I told him it was purely a brother-sister relationship, no sex. I was never going to get Boston into trouble." So after this, Tyler called Stephen and they talked about it. But the next day, Joanne told Tyler that she had handed over the diary and also a towel that had been on Boston's bed to the police. Tyler cried and screamed at her mother. She knew that the details of her and Stephen's sexual relationship were in the diary. So apparently, there was also DNA evidence on the towel that would relate to Tyler and Stephen.
So this all led to a huge fight, and Tyler insisted on leaving the house. And Joanna told her no, so Tyler called 911 pretending to be Joanne. She claimed that her daughter had attacked her and wanted her taken from the house. But this was just Tyler's way of trying to get out of the house. She had attacked her mother and thrown things at her after learning that Joanne had turned over the diary. Eventually, Joanne got on the phone and explained the real circumstances of the argument. She admitted that she felt unable to control her daughter and was very concerned. Tyler could be heard yelling at her mother in the background. She was taken to juvenile hall, but she was released and sent back home within a few hours. So I take it Joanne has been trying to get psychiatric help for Tyler? I mean, she's trying to do everything she can to help her daughter.
That's a good question. I don't know if she was in therapy, but she certainly should have been, and maybe on medication. She definitely had some serious issues.
Why, yes.
Because at the time of that call, Joanne was injured by Tyler. She had gotten violent. And maybe she should have left her in juvenile hall and made sure she got help. But I think she always had that guilt hanging over her ever since Tyler had been taken away as a child. So she didn't really follow through with things as harshly as maybe she would have otherwise.
Yeah.
But nothing seemed to deter Tyler. She wasn't afraid of the police or anything. She kept calling Stephen and complaining about having searing pains, stomach aches, anorexia, and migraines, and she kept asking to see him. When summer school began for Tyler, Stephen would sometimes pick her up from where her mom dropped her off, and they would spend time together in his car. But then it wasn't long before Stephen started going over to see Tyler at her house when Joanne wasn't at home. So they're falling right back into these patterns, which are forbidden.
Same old habits.
Yes.
So Stephen didn't go in through the front door, because then he would have to drive to a locked gate with a security code. Both he and Tyler were afraid that Joanne would find them out. So Stephen drove to the schoolyard behind the house and climbed over a fence, and then Tyler would meet him in her backyard. Tyler later admitted that on some of their daytime visits, when they both knew Joanne was at work, he and Tyler were having sex again. Joanne may have thought that Tyler's relationship with Stephen was over, but in reality, Tyler was continuing to see him, and the only real change was that she was angrier than ever at her mother. She blamed Joanne for ruining her one happy relationship. One time, Tyler lied and told her mother that she's going over to her girlfriend's house when she was actually meeting up with Stephen. When she figured this out, Joanne called the El Dorado County Sheriff's Office and told them everything that had been happening between her daughter and Stephen Culver.
Which they already should have known, but I guess she was just letting them know that it hadn't stopped?
I would think. I mean, they'd been called previously.
Right, and they got the diary.
Yeah, so they know.
So the police did pick her up, but Tyler lied again, saying that Stephen was only like a big brother to her. And when asked why she'd been naked next to his bedroom, she said she'd been changing her clothes and just wanted his opinion on her outfit. Now, I can't imagine they believed that. But Tyler and Stephen had their story straight, because when a deputy called Stephen, who was working at Rubio's restaurant at the time, Stephen told him the same story that Tyler had. So to the deputy's repeated questions, Stephen said that he was fond of Tyler, but that they'd never had any intimate relations. So I guess they had no real evidence to the contrary, although I would think the diary would be something.
Uh-huh.
But the deputy said he couldn't arrest Stephen for statutory rape at that point.
Okay. Then for what happened next, we only have Tyler's version. She claimed that after dinner, the police left her house and she went upstairs. She said that she went to bed, and around 2 a.m, her mom came into her room and yelled at her. Tyler got angry, told her mother, get out of her room, leave her alone. But she was mimicking Tyler in a high-pitched voice, Tyler claimed, and they ended up getting into an altercation at her door. Then when Joanne finally did leave, Tyler said she just started throwing things out of her room and into the hallway.
Well, in some reports, Tyler said that she wished she could stab her mom with a knife. Tyler would deny this later, but others had heard her make that statement. Tyler did admit to saying, "Get out of my room or I'm going to run away. I'll kill you. I'll hurt you. Leave me alone." So those could be seen as serious threats.
Certainly.
After Tyler told Stephen that the police had her diary, they decided that they just needed to run away and kill themselves. So I guess this is adolescent logic. Doesn't make much sense to me.
Right.
It was a Thursday, and they thought that he would be arrested on Saturday. For some reason, they thought it would take 48 hours. I don't know where they got their ideas. So they decided they would leave on Saturday, kill themselves on Monday, because it would be like an anniversary, because their first date had been on a Monday. So, you know, that's how their brains were working, apparently. And it gets worse, because they discussed how they would end their lives, and Stephen had the idea to ingest Drano, bleach, a bottle of vodka, and Pepto-Bismol. So I don't understand that at all. That's I would think
some combination.
The worst possible way to die would be to ingest Drano or bleach. That would be awfully painful.
Sure would.
And I don't know if the Pepto-Bismol is supposed to help with that, but I don't think it's that strong a medicine that it's going to help.
No.
Tyler told him that she didn't want to die in El Dorado Hills, though. She wanted to die in a place where she didn't have any bad memories. So they said they would go to San Francisco, and they had to leave before Saturday. But then they worried that Joanne would notice Tyler was gone, and she would call the police on them. So it was crucial, Tyler said, that they made sure Joanne didn't tell the police. So Tyler would say that she and Stephen then planned that they would kill Joanne on Friday night, and that would solve the problem. She told him they'd have to use a knife, and Stephen was going to come over Friday night, and then it would happen. But Stephen wouldn't back up this story of Tyler's at all. Stephen later claimed that he had no knife with him when he arrived that Friday night. He visited while Joanne was at work, and he left the house by the time she came home. Tyler and Joanne went to the store, and Joanne said she was sorry for reading Tyler's diary. She said she understood why her daughter was upset, and then she offered to get Tyler her favorite candy and ice cream. Now, after that, according to Tyler, they went home, and Tyler played video games until around 10:30 p.m., and then went upstairs to bed. So this is, you know, kind of a spoiled girl.
Well, that's an understatement.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to be too judgmental about it, but she seems like she just expects everything to be given to her. And she's not respectful to other people. Tyler said that she stopped by her mother's room and saw that she was asleep with the TV on. She noticed a glass of gold-colored liquid on her mother's nightstand, and then she said she became really angry that her mother had broken her promise to her not to drink. So she turned off her mother's TV and went to her room.
And then she called Stephen. She said that she was really mad, and she just vented her frustrations on Stephen. She then suggested that it was a good time to kill her mother because she was drunk. So Tyler decided that she would put Vicodin in her mother's drink in case she woke up. And she said that Stephen agreed to this plan.
Well, Stephen later had a very different version of what had happened. He said, "I got to work about 3 o'clock and did my regular routine. Tyler called me a couple of times, which was normal for that period of time. I worked a normal shift and it ended around 10 o'clock. I didn't leave there until 10:15. Stephen claimed that Tyler never mentioned to him anything about killing Joanne. But Tyler said, "The plan was I would get off the phone and I would call him again when I was sure that she was sound asleep. He would come over and come inside the house and kill my mother. So I went downstairs to the medicine cabinet to get the Vicodin bottle, but it wasn't there. I checked in my mom's car and it wasn't there. So I went back into the medicine cabinet to see if I could find anything else." So Tyler said that she ended up crushing up some vitamins and putting those into her mother's drink. I don't understand the rationale there at all, what that would do.
No, I think there's something she read somewhere, or claims she read somewhere. It's just
stupid.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. But according to her, Joanne got up between 11 and 11:30 to let the dog out. Then she washed out her glass and went back to bed.
And according to Stephen, he got a call from Tyler around 10:30 that night. She was upset and crying. She asked him to come by her house because she was so frustrated and angry with her mother getting drunk and breaking her promise not to get drunk again. Stephen tried to explain to her that it was a bad idea. They wanted to kill themselves, and it was a bad idea for him to go over to her house, especially in the middle of the night, and especially since the police had the diary describing their relationship. But eventually he conceded. Because she had kept asking and pleading, he said he got into his car and went to El Dorado Hills. He called Tyler around 11 o'clock to let her know that he was at the school behind the house. Tyler called back saying she heard her mom wake up or something, so he needed to wait. She told Stephen to wait 20-25 minutes until she was sure her mom was asleep. So Stephen said that he waited at the school, smoking a cigarette and waiting. After about 40 minutes with no call, he tried calling Tyler, but it went straight to her voicemail. Then a couple minutes later, she called him. Stephen would recall, "She was frantic on the phone. She was panting. I thought she was crying. She was upset. I tried to reassure her, and she told me to come around to the side of the house." Now, that was unusual, because normally for our evening visits, I would come by the back, stay by the back fence, and stay off the property. I tried to convince her that I should not come by the side of the house, but I eventually conceded. I thought, maybe she needs a hug from me. So I walked into the backyard through the side gate door. The dogs came up, and I knelt down beside them and started playing with them. Tyler wasn't outside yet, so I sat there waiting, trying to figure out what was taking Tyler so long. Eventually, she cracked open the door on the side of the house, whispered my name, and asked where I was. I stood up and started walking toward the door. She flung it open and came out.
But Tyler would tell a different story about what happened that night. She told investigators, "I was sitting on my windowsill and I saw him walk onto the driveway and go through the back gate. His car was parked at the school. It was because my mom had told me that when you type in the code to get into our gate, she would know about it later. So I thought that if he came through the gate using our code, that it would get logged. So I had told him not to come in through the gate, but to go to the school. He'd been doing that since my mom had told the police. When I saw him, I went downstairs, went through a side door, and I smoked a couple of cigarettes with him in the backyard. We talked, and I was really edgy in talking about going to San Francisco. It was a pretty quick conversation about what was going to happen. I said, 'Okay, I'll go inside. You go upstairs, and then just go through her door. Her door is open.' And he had a knife with him. He showed it to me. He got it from where he worked. It was wrapped in a Rubio's restaurant plastic bag. Finally, we got enough nerve to go back inside the house. I opened the door and let him inside. We were walking and I heard a creaking noise, and I thought it was my mom getting up. So I told him to go wait in the bathroom that was across from the laundry room downstairs. I went upstairs to check, and she was still sound asleep. I came back downstairs, got him out of the bathroom, and I led him upstairs. He had a knife in his hand. He was holding it like he was going to chop something and cook it. We went into the room, and I was sitting with my back to one of the doors waiting, and I didn't hear anything. So I peeked in the door, and I saw him posed. He was practicing. He was trying to see the angle that would work best. He was holding the blade facing outward and moving his arm and elbow. When I saw that, I went to my position by the door. I was waiting for the noise to start, and then I heard rustling. My mom woke up. There was a knife in my hand. I stood up, and I was in the doorway. I couldn't do it. I couldn't go inside. I put the knife on a counter beside the bathroom door and went back and sat down against the door. With my hands over my ears, I closed my eyes and hummed, but I did hear her tell him to stop once.
Tyler then claimed that she had put her hands over her ears and hummed in order to block out the sounds of Stephen killing her mother. She said that he came out of the room holding the knife. She hugged him and told him that everything would be okay. She saw blood on his pants leg, and he had what looked like a bloody teardrop near his left eye. Stephen later stated that none of that had happened. He said when Tyler flung open the door to the house, she was holding a kitchen knife in her hand, and she had a red stain on her pant leg. He said he didn't know what to expect, but because she wasn't coming towards him in an aggressive way, he stopped and waited for her to say something. Then she said, "Boston, I did it. I finally did it. My mom is gone forever."
And Stephen would claim to be shocked by what Tyler had done. She tried explaining that the police would come soon and she would go to prison. He wanted to get out of the house and told her that they needed to leave. She said she needed to grab some stuff, so he followed her upstairs. In Tyler's version, she said, "I went into my room, got my bag that the clothing was in, and I had some other stuff. I told Boston not to touch anything. Before I went downstairs, I told him to wait, and I was going to close the windows and the blinds and turn on the air conditioning. When I went back to the room, he held up a SpongeBob blanket so that I couldn't see my mother, and he kind of draped it over her. Then we went downstairs, and I got another one of my bags. I looked for any alcohol that might have been left in the house, but it was locked up. So we went out through the garage door, and I let him out. Then I closed it and locked it from the inside and went out the doggy door." So it's kind of funny to me, not funny, haha, but strange, that the liquor's locked up. So what, you're not going to break open the liquor cabinet, but you're okay with killing your mother?
Right. Some incongruencies there.
Only a 14-year-old could think that way.
Now, Stephen's version claimed that when I followed her up the stairs, I moved the knife into my left hand so I could hold her and put my arm on her back in case she fell or stumbled. When we got to the top of the stairs, the door was open. That's the door to Joanne's bedroom. Tyler said we needed to close the windows because the neighbor's dogs would probably bark at the smell. So after walking out of the room, I asked Tyler if she's done packing yet, and she said, "No, not yet. Check to see that all the doors are locked." And before I did that, there was a SpongeBob blanket on the workout equipment. I shifted the knife and held the handle with my pinky and ring finger pointing downward. I grabbed the blanket with my middle index finger and thumb, unfolded it, and billowed it out to cover her body. From all the blood, I knew there was nothing I could do for her. Anything like calling an ambulance or 911 would only get Tyler arrested. And I was already scared of going to prison for a couple of years because of that likely statutory rape charge. So I figured, how much of a boyfriend was I if I called the cops and she went away to prison for life?
Okay.
If our plan was to die together, then we needed to stick to that. When I covered her up, I thought, this is really unreal.
So boy, I don't think either one of them is really telling the truth here.
No, I think you ought to patch a little bit of her story and a little bit of his story.
Yeah, I think you'd have to. So if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know that we are obsessed with playing Best Fiends. In my humble but correct opinion, it's the best Match 3 style game by far. The rest are basically just the same game with different color schemes. So come on, guys, stop crushing the same old candy. Try a puzzle game with something fresh to offer.
With Best Fiends, you play through an actual storyline, complete with good guys, that's the fiends, and not so good guys, the slugs. Your fiends start off as wee baby versions of their future selves. The more you play, the more fiends join your team, and the more powerful they become, helping you to solve increasingly challenging puzzles as you progress through the game.
Well, I just love Best Fiends. It's action-packed, it's brain-boosting, and with new content added constantly, you never get bored. I'm not going to brag, but I am now at level 692, way past Dicky. There's no concern about running out of levels either, because there are literally thousands of levels, and more are being added all the time. And playing Best Fiends just fits so well into any lifestyle. You can binge play for hours, or just pick it up for a round or two while you're waiting in line or just relaxing on the couch.
Best Fiends really is the perfect thing for a little pick-me-up and a fresh challenge. So download the 5-star rated puzzle game, Best Fiends, free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
In one version of the events told by Tyler, she was the one who closed the curtains and turned on the air conditioning. She said later she did this to make the neighbors believe someone was at home when it got hot outside during the day. But later she would say that Stephen turned on the air conditioning so her mother's body would not decompose as quickly, causing an odor. Tyler continued her story from there, stating that she and Stephen went to his car and drove to his house. They didn't talk at all about what had happened, according to Tyler. They went to his dad's house, and Steve had comforted her as she cried. But she wasn't crying for her mother. She was crying for herself and for what would happen to her now. Stephen burned his bloody clothes in the fireplace and took a shower, she said, and then they stayed there for about an hour. They then drove to the library parking lot in El Dorado Hills and slept in the car. Then they went to the Holiday Inn parking lot and tried to sleep there. They only slept for about 30 minutes, she said.
Now Stephen, later on, would describe things differently. He said, we drove to my dad's house. When we walked in, I turned on the lights and sat down in the room. Tyler saw the fireplace and said, we need to burn these clothes. And my dad had a supply of logs behind the garage, so I began collecting some small pieces of wood to use as kindling to start a fire. I went back to my car to grab a set of my clothes, because I wanted everything burned. She had touched me with bloody hands, and I didn't want anything remaining. So after starting the fire, I added the clothes, almost one at a time, because I didn't want to accidentally snuff it out. Around then, Tyler told me the last thing her mother had said to her. Please don't kill me, I promise I won't. And she never finished the sentence. Then Tyler asked me what I thought her mom meant by I promise I won't. And I told her I didn't know. I told Tyler we should take a shower and clean everything off. I added the last piece of clothing to the fireplace to burn while we were taking a shower. It was about 2 a.m. by that point. We needed to lie down and get some sleep. So we were at my house for a couple hours, then we drove to the El Dorado Hills Library, just trying to find a place to where we could park and get a couple hours sleep. We were there only 45 minutes to an hour. And I saw a security guard passing by and stopping and looking at our car. So I didn't want to talk to him or explain anything. From there, we drove down El Dorado Hills Boulevard toward Jackson Elementary School. We were parked at Jackson, and my idea was to move Joanne's car, park it down in a remote area, and then just leave it. But when we had gone there and I opened the door, beginning to walk back to the house, all of a sudden we heard a siren, and we froze. So I told Tyler it was a bad idea to go back to the house. We left the area, went to a Safeway.
So next, Stephen said, they went to get a cranberry drink from Starbucks for Tyler. He asked her what she thought they should get for their trip to San Francisco, and she said that they should get hair dye to dye their hair and make it difficult for anyone to recognize them. I just get the feeling from a lot of what she said that this was an adventure to her. She was kind of enjoying it.
Yeah, it certainly reads that way.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
So they did buy some hair dye and makeup for Tyler at the Safeway. Then they went to the 99-cent store in Orangevale and bought snacks. So it's like a little road trip.
Mm-hmm.
I really have a hard time believing they ever really wanted to die. But they went to a bank where Stephen withdrew cash, and then to a Home Depot, and they bought some rat poison at the Home Depot as part of their new plan to poison themselves. After Home Depot, they drove to the Sports Authority, where Stephen bought a new pair of biking gloves. Now, if he was going to kill himself within hours, why did he buy biking gloves? I don't know. After that, they went back to El Dorado Hills to get haircuts and eat breakfast at a cafe. Now it was about 10 a.m., and Stephen called his friend Matt Widman, asking if he and Tyler could come by his house. So they went to Matt's house and dyed their hair in his bathroom. Both Tyler and Stephen said that they told Matt Widman that they were going to San Francisco to kill themselves. They didn't say why they were going to commit suicide, but they all went to the town center to buy some marijuana and ecstasy. And what happened next was important because Tyler and Stephen had very different versions of this. Stephen said that Tyler had told him that Matt Widman needed to know why they were going to kill themselves, because it would be cruel for his two closest friends to just go off and kill themselves and leave him with no explanation. So they sat down with Matt, and Stephen asked if he really wanted to know the reason why they were running away. Matt said yes, so Stephen went out to the car and got a plastic shopping bag with a knife in it and showed it to Matt. Then he told him that he had killed Tyler's mom.
Stephen told Matt that he had waited at the school behind Tyler's house. Tyler called him when her mom was passed out drunk, he said, and she led him into the house where he stabbed Joanne to death. He said that he slit her throat and stabbed her in her neck and stomach. The last part of this sentence is notable, because Joanne had not been stabbed in the stomach. So whether Stephen lied to protect Tyler, or if he stabbed her in the dark and he didn't know that he hadn't stabbed her in the stomach, that's unknown. But Matt Widman recalled that the knife was bloody, and when Tyler looked at the knife, it was about the only time she showed any emotion, according to Matt. She teared up. She was sitting on the counter eating ramen, and she joined in the conversation, saying that she had spiked her mom's drink with Vicodin. Stephen knew that was not true, but he didn't correct her. So they took some pills, smoked some weed, and then Tyler and Stephen left for San Francisco.
So I'd have to question this Matt Widman. Wouldn't you call the police if your friend said that and left?
I would.
Yeah.
But maybe he considers himself a really good friend and an ally, and he's going to help.
Well, why not at least stop their suicides? If not getting them in trouble for the mother, you think he would at least try and stop that?
Yeah, that's true. Although maybe he didn't think they were actually going to go through with it.
He might not have, because I'm not sure they were going to anyway. But the next morning, Stephen and Tyler were just like tourists in San Francisco. They window shopped at the Chinese shops, and they watched the cable cars. Stephen recalled that they got there around 2 in the morning, and they stayed in a cheap motel. Then they looked at some tourist sites, and they went to stay at a better place, the Holiday Inn. And during their stay in San Francisco, Stephen texted his co-worker Dylan and told him he was out of town and he was never coming back. Tyler later said that they went back to the hotel, and there was a table beside the bed that was big enough to sit around, and they sat there and wrote goodbye letters to some family members and friends. Stephen also wrote a letter to whom it may concern. He wrote that when people were in love, they would speak in analogies, travel through the pits of hell, walk across the country barefoot, or suffer the most brutal of tortures, all for the sake and well-being of their loved one. But he wrote, it is the true test when faced with the task of taking the life of another to be with the one you love. So that doesn't make him look innocent at all.
Not in the least.
The next day was Sunday, and they slept in. They went to the Japan Center and had lunch. That evening, they went to dinner at an Italian restaurant. They mailed the goodbye letters from a UPS store. Then sometime during their stay at the hotel, Tyler went onto the internet to look at MySpace. Tyler and Stephen may have trusted Matt Widman not to tell anyone what they had told him. But Matt had spoken to a friend, who in turn had spoken to another friend named Graham.
Yeah, so Graham wrote to Tyler, "You sicken me beyond anything." Tyler replied that she hadn't been involved in the murder, but she did get to be with Stephen now. And for her, that was all that mattered. This MySpace conversation went back and forth between Graham and Tyler. He insisted that she was involved in the murder of her mother, but she insisted that she wasn't. She even wrote on her MySpace account that she had nothing to do with it, and neither did Boston. Graham wrote in disbelief that it didn't make any sense that anyone else except those two would kill Tyler's mom. Tyler answered, "Well, what does it matter? What if we did?"
So the next day was Monday, the day they were supposed to kill themselves. So they mixed rat poison pellets with cake and mixed it with some milk, also some Fruit Loops, I guess, and they ate it around midnight. Tyler said she had some stomach pains the next day, but Stephen was fine. Since they hadn't died like they'd planned, they thought about some other ways to kill themselves. So Tyler said they thought about using razor blades or jumping off the roof of the hotel. They looked for a place to jump off the building, but the staircase had a gate, and they couldn't get on it together at the same time, so one would have to jump first and then the other. But Tyler said she was really afraid of heights, so she passed on this option. While Tyler and Stephen were in San Francisco talking about ways to die, no one at Joanne's job had seen or heard from her. Joanne had taken off from work unannounced before because of problems with Tyler. Joanne's friend and co-worker, Vincent Catapano, that's the Vinny who'd come over before to help get Stephen out of the house, thought that Joanne and Tyler had planned on going camping together so that Joanne could try and talk to her and maybe get through to her. But when Joanne didn't call or show up for work on Monday, June 15th, Vincent was really worried. He told Joanne's supervisor that Joanne had been having trouble with her daughter and her daughter's boyfriend.
So they called the sheriff's office to do a welfare check at Joanne's home. A deputy went by the house, but the doors were locked, and no one answered the door or the phone. So Joanne's father, Norbert, and one of her brothers, Michael, were contacted and asked to come over and check inside the house. They did, and what they found was just a terrible, shocking, bloody crime scene.
Yeah, I just can't imagine. Joanne was lying on her bed, covered in blood. She'd obviously been dead for days. Because of past reports Joanne had made to the sheriff's office about her daughter and Stephen Culver, an all-points bulletin, APB, was put out by the sheriff's office right away to find them. And soon there were TV broadcasts with photos of Tyler and Stephen. Since Tyler and Stephen were busy wandering around to the south of San Francisco, they probably didn't see any of these photos, but they may have heard something on the radio about Joanne's body being found. Stephen would mention that later to the investigators.
On June 17th, 2009, Tyler and Stephen were walking around in the city of San Bruno when an off-duty police officer, Michael Garcia, saw them kissing. Now, they looked to him just like the photos of Stephen Culver and Tyler Witt, except these two had darker hair. So the couple walked into a mall after their kiss and walked towards a dumpster. And when Garcia pulled up beside them, they were changing clothes. Garcia identified them and then arrested them. Now, the June 17 issue of Placerville's Mountain Democrat newspaper had the headline, "Woman Found Dead, Daughter, Boyfriend Suspected." The article read that Joanne Witt, age 47, had been found murdered in her home. There was a large photo of the police activity around Joanne's home, along with photos of the suspects and the victim.
Well, the arrests were a shock, but they were also a relief to neighborhood residents. It was a shock that Joanne's daughter was involved in her death, but it was also a relief that there wasn't a serial killer loose in their neighborhood. Reporters started talking to Joanne's neighbors and co-workers. Vincent Catapano said that he planned to have dinner with Joanne on June 12th, and Joanne had told him that she wanted to take Tyler camping over the weekend, and she wanted to leave her car with Vincent and use his pickup truck. When she didn't come by, he thought, well, she'd probably just used her car to go camping instead. Vincent said that there had been many times in the past when Joanne would forget plans because she had to deal with her daughter's constant problems. He said that Tyler was always Joanne's number one priority. Vincent also told reporters that Joanne had let Stephen live with her when his parents had moved out of the area. He knew that Joanne and Tyler had had an argument about Stephen on June 11th because Joanne had left the office early that day to talk to her daughter. And Vincent had tried calling Joanne several times on Saturday morning but got no answer. When he heard the news of her murder on Monday morning, he was just devastated. He said Joanne was a smart, caring woman, and everyone at work really loved her.
According to Vincent, Tyler had been a typical 14-year-old before she got involved with Stephen. Tyler had already been acting out some, but everything went downhill when Stephen came into the picture. Joanne had found drugs in the house because of Stephen, and the 19-year-old had started a sexual relationship with Tyler. So Tyler and Stephen were taken back to El Dorado County for their first court date. Deputy District Attorney Lizette Souter's statement of facts on the case included the sexual affair between Tyler and Stephen, Joanne finding out about it, and Stephen moving out of the house and promising not to ever contact Tyler again. When Joanne found Tyler's diary, she knew that she was lying. Tyler's diary detailed their sexual encounters with Stephen, and she bragged about deceiving her mom. Joanne had told the detective about the diary, and when Tyler refused to tell them the truth, Joanne gave the police the journal. So it was the prosecution's theory that this prompted Tyler and Stephen to their decision to kill Joanne. After being arraigned, decision was made to try both Stephen and Tyler as adults for first-degree murder. It didn't matter if Tyler was still only 14 years old, because this was such a heinous crime. If found guilty, Tyler could be sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Yeah, that's just always a tough one. That's so young. It's really a child. But it is a heinous crime, and she did sound kind of awful. So it's really hard. Although I really am not sure we should be trying children of that age as adults.
Well, we've covered a few cases like this, or
we
comparable
have.
To this before, and I think that we've pretty much been consistent with the idea that young teens have different brains than adults, and it might not be the best idea to incarcerate a 14-year-old forever.
Well, sure, and we've covered cases in Canada, at least one I can think of with a 13-year-old who just went to a juvenile facility until she was 18 and then left and got a new name and, as far as we know, has been a successful adult, nonviolent.
That's right.
So it's really hard to judge someone by what they do at 14. I know I was an idiot. But then on the other hand, the violence and the meanness
right.
is not normal for a 14-year-old, even a stupid one.
No.
So it is a tough situation. Several motions were filed by Tyler's attorney and by Stephen's attorney. One motion was to disallow the admittance of a story written by Tyler in the spring of 2009, called The Killer and His Raven. The story was set in medieval times, and the protagonist was a 19-year-old man who had met a smart, beautiful 14-year-old girl. It began with the two meeting and becoming friends. The young man learned that she was living with a drunken, abusive mother, and he promised to protect her. As the young man and the girl spent more time with each other, they realized that they loved each other. And the girl was able to talk her mother into letting the young man move in with them. In the girl's house, they started a forbidden sexual relationship. They were deeply in love, but one day the girl's mother caught them having sex. And she kicked the young man out of the house and demanded that the daughter never see him again. But the girl couldn't keep away from him, and her resentment against her mother grew. The lovers secretly met, but then the mother got suspicious and went to the police with the girl's diary. This is when their hopes vanished and the 19-year-old man stabbed the mother to death in her sleep. The lovers then ran away, knowing that they would be found out, and killed themselves in a suicide pact.
Well, that sounds remarkably similar to the facts.
Spot on, really.
So this story was not direct evidence, of course, but the obvious similarity between the plot and real life was undeniable. At first, the judge ruled that the story could not be admitted as evidence. But then he changed his mind and allowed it as long as Tyler and Stephen had separate trials.
So they both stayed in jail awaiting trial, but then in September 2010, Tyler decided to take a plea offer from the DA's office. Spending her life in jail for close to a year seemed to have brought her back to reality a bit, and part of the plea deal stated that it wasn't contingent on a successful prosecution of Stephen, and it did require that she had to be truthful when called to give a statement or testimony. She had to agree to murder in the first degree, special circumstances of lying in wait, and special circumstances for killing a witness to a felony crime. Because Joanne Witt had been a witness to Stephen Culver being involved in statutory rape, so Tyler would have to admit in court that she was guilty, and she would have to cooperate with investigators and give a truthful statement about her involvement with Stephen in the murder of her mother. The statements had to cover the events before the murder, during the murder, and after the murder. Tyler also had to go with a detective to the location where the knife used to kill Joanne had been thrown away by her and Stephen. And she would have to waive her right to appeal once she was sentenced. So the DA agreed that after the sentencing of Stephen Culver for the murder of Joanne, charges of first-degree murder against Tyler would then be reduced to second-degree murder. Tyler would then be sentenced to 15 years to life, and there would be consequences for Tyler if she violated any part of this plea deal.
Yeah, if any of her testimony against Stephen was proven false, the plea would remain in effect, but Tyler would get 25 years to life. So both Tyler and her attorney, Mark Ralphs, agreed that they had read the plea agreement and agreed with the things written there. So the agreement was signed by Tyler, Mark Ralphs, and the DA on September 17, 2010. Stephen's attorney told reporters that Tyler's plea deal made things simpler for his client. "It clarifies our position that he didn't do it," he said, "because he did not arrive at the house until Joanne Witt was already dead." He added that there was no evidence that Stephen had ever intended to hurt Joanne. It was Tyler who had kept saying she wished her mother was dead.
Well, before the trial, Stephen's attorney was allowed to read a Child Protective Services report about Tyler. Then jury selection for the trial finally did begin on May 3, 2011. And that only took a week. Opening statements began on May 17, 2011. The deputy DA, Lizette Souter, told the jurors that this was a case about a 19-year-old man and a 14-year-old girl and their love affair. She said that Stephen cut Joanne's throat with a knife and stabbed her at least 20 times. The motive was that Joanne Witt was the only person who stood between him and Tyler. She admitted that there had been bumps in the road between the mother and daughter, but Stephen was a dark individual who was obsessed with anime, blood, gore, and death. She said he had a fetish for knives as well. So overall, she said that he was the killer, and he had been a bad influence on Tyler.
Now, Stephen's attorney, Dane Wiener, said that Stephen was a hardworking young man who went to college and wanted to become a math teacher. It was Tyler who was the dark individual, he said. She had pulled Stephen into her lies because she was a master manipulator. The murder was not committed by Stephen, he said, but by Tyler. Stephen was infatuated with Tyler so much that he went along with her plans, even telling friends that he killed Joanne. But it was a lie, he told to protect Tyler. He took responsibility for an act he did not commit.
Well, and if that's true, he really screwed himself over.
If that's true.
If that's true, then she really manipulated this guy.
It is a truly noble gesture.
Yes, I note some sarcasm in your tone.
No, not me.
No. Yeah, I'm just really not sure who actually did it, to be honest with you. But sometimes two people get together, and individually they may have been okay, but together they're terrible, and things just go in a horrible direction. I really believe that happens.
Oh, yeah.
If she'd met a guy that was not violent, that was more her age, maybe none of that would have happened. And the same thing for him. If he hadn't gotten involved with her, he may have continued in college and turned out to be a teacher and never been violent in his life. We just don't know.
We don't.
But Wiener added that Stephen arrived at the Witt house after Tyler had already killed her mother. Joanne had been stabbed more than 20 times, and it looked like she hadn't put up much of a struggle. Several of the knives were missing from a block on Joanne Witt's kitchen counter, but it was unknown if detectives had even searched for them. Wiener proposed that Tyler could have used one of those knives to kill her mother. He also alleged that the crime scene in Joanne's house had been compromised. The family dog was found with blood on its muzzle after the deputies had left the bedroom, and no testing of the blood on the dog had been done. Now, it's a bloody scene, though, so I don't know if that's a big deal.
I don't know. I mean, other than mentioning that, I don't know how germane it is to this discussion.
Yeah, me either. It seems like they handled it pretty well. They did go right after finding Tyler and Stephen.
Yeah.
As soon as she was found. A portion of Tyler's diary was submitted as evidence for Stephen's defense. And in one entry, Tyler had written, "My mother is driving me insane. I hate her. She is bipolarly insane, and is turning me into the same thing. I just wish she would die somehow, some way, and leave me the fuck alone. So she's a sweetheart.
Yes, we've learned that.
Yes.
So Joanne's father, his name is Norbert Witt. People call him Norb. He testified that his daughter was an intelligent, hardworking single mother who wanted only the best for Tyler. Now, Norb said there had been friction between mother and daughter for years, but it had certainly escalated when Tyler hit her teen years. Having had a teenage daughter himself at one time, Norb said that Tyler's acting out went way beyond what was normal.
Now, my heart really breaks for Joanne's parents. They've lost their daughter, and then it was done by their granddaughter?
Yeah.
It's a huge loss. So Joanne's co-worker, Vincent, testified about one morning when Joanne arrived at work with a gash on her face, but she wouldn't say how she got it. Vincent suspected that Tyler had hit her mother in the face, because he'd seen some of Tyler's outbursts before. Once he was at a dinner at Joanne's when Tyler was just yelling at her mom in front of the guests. It was outrageous. And there were other times when Tyler got angry and left the house in a huff, slamming the door. And her mother had no idea where she was. And Joanne would just cry. He felt really bad for her. He also said that Joanne had told him that Tyler had said to her, "I wish you were dead."
Dylan Deutsch, who was a peer of Tyler's who had known her for years, testified that Tyler seemed sincerely happy when she talked about her mother dying. He had heard Tyler referred to her family life as DM, which was an abbreviation for Devil's Mafia. On the day before Joanne's death, Dylan and Tyler had both been in summer school together. During a break, Tyler told him, "If she died, I wouldn't be sad."
Now I get it. Her mom wasn't perfect. But she did do a hell of a lot for her. And she seemed pretty understanding about this whole thing. A lot of parents would have reacted a lot more harshly about this.
I think so. I wish, though, that she had been more forceful.
Well, yeah. I think that that incident when she was little, that we don't completely understand, really had a long-term effect on Joanne's parenting. And Tyler sure turned into a horrible brat.
Yeah. Well, maybe there was more to it than was suggested, and Joanne was afraid that she might be found out or something.
Maybe. Or maybe she was afraid her daughter would kill her, which turns out is not unreasonable. On direct, Matt Widman said that Tyler and Stephen came over to his parents' house on the morning of June 12, 2009, and told him they planned to kill themselves. Later that day, Stephen showed Matt the bloody knife. He said that he stabbed Joanne in the throat and stomach and killed her. Matt continued by saying that Tyler had heard her mom die, and Joanne's last words to Stephen were, "No, Boston, no." Matt surprised everyone when he admitted that he had a romantic relationship with Stephen Culver at one time and had considered him to be his boyfriend. So there was a bit of truth to the gay thing. Maybe he was bisexual.
Yeah.
Seems like he probably was.
Well, maybe he was just experimenting.
That's true, too. Well, Matt testified that Stephen was one of the nicest people he had ever met, though. He never had seemed like the kind of person who would do something like this. On cross-examination, Matt said that Stephen seemed withdrawn and quiet after the murder of Joanne, but that Tyler didn't seem bothered at all. He'd previously heard Tyler say that she wished her mother was dead, but he had never heard Stephen say anything about wanting any harm to come to Joanne. So if Stephen killed Joanne, it would have been at the desires of Tyler.
Right.
I don't think he would have done that just to save himself from being arrested.
No. So evidence that was found when the detectives entered Tyler and Stephen's room at the Holiday Inn included bags, cups, cans, clothes, and food. A half-eaten red velvet cake was in the room, along with boxes of decon rat poison.
So I just don't see this as a serious suicide attempt.
No, it's not.
And I'm not one to write one off at all, even a call for help, but who would care what they're eating like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just the stuff they bought and the things they did. I don't buy it.
No, I don't either. There was a bedsheet with a red stain on it that had been thrown into a corner of the room. There are two plastic bowls of cereal with pellets of rat poison. And thrown onto the floor of the bathroom were several towels that had red stains on them. In a note left there, which had been written by Tyler, she compared her and Stephen to Romeo and Juliet. Well, of course, that's what I'd expect a 14-year-old to do.
Sure.
She said that her dead mother had forced her to make a devil's deal. The note went on. I hate you, Mother. I hope you never forget that. I want Stephen and I to be buried together. We loved each other. Although I was young, I knew my love was true.
Well, Tyler testified against Stephen. By that time, she was 16 years old, but her attorney had dressed her to look like a very innocent young girl. She was very calm on the stand and answered prosecutors' questions as her former lover, Stephen Culver, watched, and he had very little expression on his face. Tyler described the events leading up to the murder, including how she had tried to spike her mother's drink with vitamins because there was no Vicodin left in the medicine bottle. She had wanted her mother to sleep and not be able to call the police when she and Stephen had left for San Francisco. But according to Tyler, Stephen showed up at the house with a 10-inch butcher knife taken from Rubio's restaurant. Tyler said that she then grabbed a knife from the kitchen, and they both walked up the stairs to her mother's bedroom. When Stephen made a few practice slashes in the air with a knife, she said she got scared. She couldn't go inside the bedroom. She said that she sat down in the hallway and cupped her hands over her ears. She blocked out some of the sounds of her mother being stabbed to death, but she said she heard her mother cry out as she was being stabbed. And after it was over, she said she saw Stephen come out of the room and one of his pant legs was soaked with blood.
And then when Tyler was asked by Stephen's lawyer if Stephen had been wearing any gloves when he supposedly killed Joanne Witt, Tyler said, yeah, he was wearing gloves. Surprised by this answer, Weiner sarcastically said, and of course, you mentioned that detail to Detective Lensing and Miss Souter? Tyler seemed taken aback by this. She answered, he usually wears gloves, so I might have... I probably didn't. I just don't remember looking at his hands. Weiner asked, are you just adding details as you go? Tyler said she wasn't, that she was just trying to remember what had occurred.
And she was a little snarky, from what I gather.
Yeah.
Not intimidated by anyone, and just kind of... still had an attitude. She did claim that she had found religion and then made the decision to take responsibility for her role in her mother's murder, and that's why she had accepted a plea deal. But Stephen's attorney brought up another possible reason for her taking the plea deal and agreeing to testify, and that was to get less time in prison with a reduced charge of second-degree murder.
Bingo.
But Tyler replied, I'm just here to tell the truth.
Of course. So crime scene investigator Jeremy Buckman introduced the letters left in a car that Stephen and Tyler had abandoned in San Francisco. In one letter, Stephen had thanked his mother for instilling in him a sense of moral justice. He went on to write that he appreciated her raising him to be polite and considerate of others. And then he wrote, I regret to admit I have not given her the praise she most certainly deserves. I love her very much. I wish I could have been a better son to her. Stephen compared his love for Tyler to Angel Sanctuary, a series of manga comics that delved into some dark themes.
Yeah, so to this day, Stephen's mother believes he's innocent. But Buckman next showed a letter written by Tyler to Stephen, and in it she wrote, I love you more than I could ever explain. The only thing that I could think and dream about was you. And she urged him to keep on fighting to keep their love for each other hidden from her mother and all adults. She told him they must hide it in the darkest shadows. And at the end of the letter, she told Stephen to burn it. And, you know, obviously he hadn't.
No.
After Buckman's testimony was completed, both the prosecution and the defense stipulated that since Tyler had been in jail, she had attended church every Sunday, which I'd say big fucking deal.
Yeah, no kidding.
Investigator Sean Eastman spoke of the plea deal that Tyler had made with the DA's office and her promise to reveal where the knife was that had been used to kill her mom. She said the knife had been dropped down a storm drain near Stephen's father's house after the murder. But the first search for the knife came up empty, so they went back a second time. But even with the help of the El Dorado County Department of Transportation, they couldn't find the knife. It was possible that the knife had been washed away during a storm, or it was possible that Tyler was lying.
Right.
And you know why she might do that is if it was a knife from her house, because she'd already said that Stephen brought a knife over that he used to kill her mother, a knife he'd gotten from the restaurant where he worked. So Deanna Kaser, a senior criminologist with the California Department of Justice, testified that male DNA was found in the right and left-hand fingernail scrapings of Joanne Witt, but they couldn't directly link the DNA to Stephen. During her testimony, though, she was adamant that the male DNA found on Joanne's fingernail scrapings came through direct contact, and it could not have been an innocent transfer. Also presented was DNA evidence from a bloody hand towel found in Tyler's room after the body of her mother was found. Kacer told jurors that the towel tested positive for blood and that DNA on the towel came not from Joanne, but from Tyler.
Now, Tyler had no signs of injury at the time of the murder, right?
No.
So Stephen took the stand in his own defense. He admitted to prosecutors that he had repeatedly lied to his friends, family, and the authorities, not only to protect himself, but also to preserve the relationship he had with the 14-year-old Tyler. The deputy DA, in her cross-examination, focused on the idea that his lies were told completely for self-preservation. She questioned why he had made efforts to cover up the murder of Joanne when he and Tyler were going to kill themselves just 3 days later in San Francisco. Good point.
Yeah, I know, because the whole idea that they expressed was that they didn't want anyone to find her until after they killed themselves on Monday. But the whole idea of waiting till Monday just tells me that they didn't really want to go through with that. They just wanted to get rid of Joanne.
Yeah.
So Stephen testified that when he arrived at the Witt house late on June 11th, 2009, Tyler welcomed him into the house while she was holding a bloody knife, and she confessed to the murder of her mother. He said he took the knife from her, and at her request, he closed the windows and wiped away any fingerprints he may have left there. So the jurors began deliberations on June 14th. The decision was made less than 24 hours later. So on Wednesday, June 15th, 2011, exactly 2 years after Joanne's body was discovered, the jury found Stephen guilty of first-degree murder.
So Joanne's father, Norb Witt, hugged Stephen's mother, Jan Culver, as she left the courthouse. He told reporters, "She's been hurting. I told her you had nothing to do with this. You didn't do anything wrong." Norb was upset by the way the defense had portrayed Joanne as a drunken, abusive mother. He said there will never be justice for Joanne. She was a good mother who made Tyler the center of her life. Everybody loved Joanne except her daughter.
Yeah. Before the sentencing, on August 12, 2011, the judge allowed friends and family of Joanne to make victim impact statements. Norb Witt said that the death of his daughter left a gaping hole in his life. He said, "Our daughter Joanne is gone, and we loved her very much." Norb said Joanne was a good friend and daughter, and never had a bad word to say about anybody. Then Norb addressed Stephen, saying that he'd turned Tyler into a sex addict, a drug addict, and a murderer.
Well, at least he didn't mince words.
No, he didn't.
Michael Witt, Joanne's brother, said that he hoped that Stephen would suffer a slow and painful death in prison. Then Michael said that he hoped that psychotic son of a bitch Culver experiences the worst possible experiences our wonderful prison system can bestow upon him.
So he definitely was saying it like it is.
So Judge Proud finally said to him, "I empathize with your feelings, but there are other victims in this case."
Yeah, so he had to sit down.
Yeah.
At least he got that out. Now, Jacqueline Epperson, who'd known Stephen and his family since Stephen was 15, wanted the judge to show some leniency in where Stephen would be sent to prison. She said about Stephen, "I found him to be genuine, honest, courteous, and respectful of others. He was likable, thoughtful, and trustworthy." Before pronouncing Stephen's sentence, the judge had some things to say about Stephen. He said, "No person deserves to die in the manner that took place." He noted the excessive amount of stab wounds Joanne had suffered while lying in her own bed. Then he sentenced Stephen to spend the rest of his life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, I've never met Stephen and Tyler in person, but just the excessive stabbing really makes me feel like Tyler did it, because she was the one that really had so much rage against her mother. Now, Stephen may have held that rage as well, and I just might not be aware of it.
Or he was acting under her direction, and she's watching him stab her mother and encouraging him to keep stabbing.
Wow. Yeah, it's just unimaginable that people could do something like that.
Yeah. So the judge sentenced Stephen to Mule Creek State Prison, which wasn't far away from where his family lived, so it would be easy for them to visit him. So maybe a little consolation.
Yep. There's no possibility of parole. He's going to be there for his whole life.
Right.
Which is kind of sad. He was young, but I guess he needs to be there.
And it was then Tyler's turn for sentencing. Because of her plea agreement with the DA's office, Tyler was going to be allowed to withdraw her original plea of first-degree murder and plead to second-degree murder. She waived her right to a jury trial. Mary Jean Witt, Joanne's sister and Tyler's aunt, then gave her victim impact statement. Mary Jean said she had noted a change in Tyler since she had been incarcerated. She said that now she and Tyler had long talks together, adding that Tyler understood what she had done with Stephen Culver was wrong, and that was the reason for her plea of guilty.
Well, Norb Witt's statement was less kind. He told Tyler that over the years, her mother had dedicated her life to her, her only child. She spent most of her income on things for Tyler, and more than once, her mother had ended a potential relationship because of her daughter. Norb said that Tyler never appreciated her mother and what her mother had done for her. He said that Tyler was Joanne's whole world, and that she had done everything so that Tyler could have the best possible life. Norb listed that Tyler had lived in beautiful, comfortable homes in good neighborhoods with good schools. She'd had music lessons, dance lessons, taekwondo, acting lessons, riding lessons, summer camp, and even a $5,900 John Robert Powers modeling course and portfolio. Joanne had taken Tyler on cruises, camping trips, vacations to Boston, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., Disneyland, Universal Studios, Hawaii, Mexico, and Jamaica. He ended by saying, "You could not accept your mother's rules. You are a murderer. You and your boyfriend planned and executed the murder of your mother. It was a vicious, brutal, and senseless murder in your mother's bedroom." And he ended by saying, "Hopefully, when you are released, you can support yourself and make a contribution to society."
Joanne's brother and Tyler's uncle, Michael, spoke next. He had been the one to go into the house after forensics was done and clean up his sister's blood. He said that Tyler could never understand what he went through then or when he had to see photos of his murdered sister in court. Because Michael had to clean up in the room, his experience were different than other family members. But he said they had all experienced extreme pain. Michael said that he hoped Tyler would realize at some point what she had done to the family. Michael told her that he couldn't understand why she had chosen to throw away all the opportunities her mother had given her. And he stated that Tyler never seemed to appreciate all the things she had been given or the love she had gotten from her mother and the rest of her family.
Well, he said they had all cared about her and Tyler had thrown it all away. Michael shared that his sister Joanne had a debilitating disease and she had told him that she didn't know how quickly it would progress. And if things got too bad or she died young, Joanne told Michael that she wanted the family to take care of Tyler. Because of her lupus, Joanne had to take a lot of medication and painkillers, and the side effects were extreme fatigue and pain. Michael added that many times Joanne would come home from work, take her pain medication, have a drink, and collapse into bed. And Tyler never appreciated all the pain that her mother was going through, and how she went to work every day to provide a good life for Tyler. Steve Witt, Joanne's other brother, said that his sister had loved Tyler from the moment she was born, and if Joanne had listened to his advice, Tyler wouldn't have ever been born. And that's because she had lupus, right? Pregnancy is difficult.
Yeah, well, that could be one. Maybe the sperm donor was not someone that Steve liked.
Well, that would be interesting because I would just like to know the genetics of the father then.
Yeah.
Right. But Steve said he was proud of the way Joanne had raised a child on her own. A couple of years before the murder, he didn't like what he was seeing, though. He said Tyler was a spoiled, selfish, deceptive, and manipulative girl. Tyler could barely hide her contempt for her mother. Steve had hoped Joanne and Tyler would eventually be able to work through these problems. He hoped it was just a phase that Tyler was going through. He had never imagined that Tyler's hatred could be so strong that she would go through with a plan that led to the murder of her own mother. So he believed that Stephen had probably done the stabbing, but that Tyler was behind it.
Yeah. Now, Tyler had been criticized for her lack of emotion during the trial. Now, her lawyer, Mark Ralphs, told the court that the reason for this was that Tyler had been prescribed mood-stabilizing drugs and actually had been on them for 2 years. He added those really prevent her from being able to cry. He claimed that Tyler did feel genuine remorse for her part in the crimes.
Now, I know you're not a psychiatrist, but what do you think of that statement?
Well, I think it's self-serving.
Yeah. Just because you're on mood stabilizers doesn't mean you can't cry when you're upset.
Right.
I guess it can kind of dull things, but yeah, I think you're right. So the judge told Tyler before her official sentencing, "Your mother was a protective and caring mother. She tried her best. I'm sorry, Ms. Witt, because the person who loved you more than anyone in the world, without reservation, is gone. You deprived your family of a mother who dedicated her life to you." He had doubts about Tyler's remorse. He said that there was no evidence that she was remorseful. Still, he sentenced her to the 15 years to life that had been agreed upon.
Right. Then a month later, in September 2011, Tyler was interviewed by 2020, and she said, "When I found out that he, that's Stephen, was going to point the finger at me, the only thing I could question was that he told me that he is going to love me no matter what, forever." Then she said that their suicide had failed because God didn't want it to work. Maybe I needed to be punished on earth.
Oogly doogly.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Just such a sad and shocking case. Just as a mother, knowing how much my children mean to me, the idea of one of them hating me so much that she would want me dead is really depressing. The idea that a child would murder their mother just seems so out of line with everything we believe about parents and their children. And with Joanne, she wasn't perfect, but she did try really hard and devoted most of her time and money to her daughter, it seems. Tyler writing off her mother as a drunk when she had lupus and was likely exhausted most of the time is just cruel. And I know teenagers can be cruel.
Yeah, they certainly can.
But it's just awful.
So Tyler's eligible for parole in 2024, and Stephen doesn't have that chance. Is that fair?
I guess. He was an adult.
Yeah?
Yeah. And she was only 14, but part of me thinks that she did the stabbing. If Stephen did do the actual stabbing, then at least we know he was definitely encouraged to do so by Tyler.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah, but he was an adult and he made that decision, so he does need to be held accountable.
Yes, he does.
All right, well, thanks for discussing this with me today. TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. And if you have comments, a case suggestion, a beer recommendation, anything really to tell us, you can send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com. You can also go to our website, tygrabber.com, and write your comments for us there, or leave us a voicemail. And your voicemail may be played on an upcoming episode, and we'd love to hear from you. I'll put a direct link to record a voicemail in our show notes, and hopefully you'll take me up on that offer. If you'd like to get your future TCB episodes commercial-free and get an extra members-only episode each and every month, as well as a gift, you might want to think about subscribing, and you could be a tie grabber on tiegrabber.com.
Cool.
Also, if you enjoy the show, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. So let's do some feedback. Why don't you start us off with a case suggestion from Michelle?
Well, actually, it's two case suggestions from Michelle. And that's who we got.
Oh, so we just have one email with two suggestions.
That is correct.
Okay, so this is a very short one. Let's do it. Let's skip the praise and jump to the stuff.
Okay.
Thank you for the praise, Michelle, but we're going to deal with these case suggestions.
Yeah, well, she thanks us for being a bright spot in her day.
Thank you so much. That's very sweet.
I distilled it down to that one sentence.
That's everything, really.
So Michelle says, "As I mentioned, I'm still making my way through the library of old episodes. So apologies if you've already covered these. But here are three cases I'd love to see you present. First is a classic, the killing of male prostitute Danny Hansford by Savannah antiques dealer Jim Williams. And we've talked about this is all from the book Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And we've discussed this case, and I'm sure we're going to do it at some point. We just haven't gotten around to it yet. Now, the second case, and a third case for that matter, these are cool. The second case is another one full of quirky characters, the killing of wealthy, elderly Texas millionaire Marjorie Nugent by mortician and man about town Bernie Teed. So interesting. There's even a 2011 movie, Bernie, about that one. Might be fun to watch.
I don't know about you, but I've seen it.
I haven't.
Okay.
Unless you're talking about Weekend at Bernie's.
No, this is one where Jack Black plays the younger man, and I think Marjorie is played by Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, we'll have to look at it.
It's a good movie, yeah. And a very sympathetic killer, which is interesting, because not a very sympathetic victim.
No.
No, so it's an interesting story, sure.
So, and then lastly, The Murder of Kentucky Beauty, Brenda Sue Schaefer, by the horrible Mel Ignatow, who through photographic evidence obtained after the trial finding him not guilty, was proven to have committed the killing. One of the few actual illustrations of double jeopardy, and how frustrating it can be when it gets turned on its head. So those are two interesting cases. The thing that was impressed on me about the Marjorie Nugent murder, Bernie was her companion.
Right.
Now, at the time of his companionship, he was 38 and Marjorie was 81. So just a minor 40-year age difference.
Sure. But she was very wealthy.
She was extremely wealthy.
And she was emotionally abusive to him.
Oh, so you're saying that's okay that he killed her?
Not saying it's okay, but you can, more than most cases, you do have a little sympathy for him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll check into it.
This double jeopardy thing, though, I find fascinating.
Yeah.
Because one of our favorite movies has been Double Jeopardy with, what's her name, Judd? Ashley Judd.
Ashley Judd and Tommy Lee.
Yes. Where a woman actually gets convicted, but her husband, I'm going to spoil it, but her husband isn't really dead. He sets her up as his killer, and he's a fake death. Mm-hmm. So then when she gets out of jail, she can kill him.
She could.
Without being arrested for it. Now, I don't know if that's ever happened in real life.
Yeah.
But this case that Michelle brings up is real and very interesting. This man was found not guilty, and then they found proof that he was guilty. And that's why a lot of the cases take longer than we want to be solved, because prosecutors are afraid that someone's going to get found not guilty, and then the evidence will come later, and it'll be too late to do anything about it. But how long can you delay it? Sometimes there's a balance there.
This evidence, it was found under a floorboard or something, so
wow.
It probably wasn't findable or easily findable. The other thing, the double jeopardy meant that he wasn't going to be tried again for the murder. He did serve a couple sentences for perjury, which, I know, minor detail.
Well, I would also wonder, did the family file a civil suit at least and get that against him?
I don't know.
Well, that would be an interesting thing to look into.
We're going to look it up.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, Michelle. You have a special place today, our only feedback person.
That's right, you're famous.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. And keep the feedback coming. We'll play more of it next week. And we'll see you next time at The Quiet End.
We'll save a seat for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.